now you're sitting there thinking, yeah, I always suspected there was something about that guy. I didn't quite stack up, and now I know it. How could fundraising be scintillating? Scintillating?
Happy. How's that? It's a happy topic. If you have it, it's happy. If you don't, it isn't. John Gardner, in his book Excellence, states that the greatest resource of any organization is the staff the organization has hired. So, we praise the Lord for each and every one of you. And if your involvement with the Navigators enriches your life as much as my involvement with the Navigator ministry has enriched my life, you will be greatly, greatly blessed. My association with the Navigators goes back several years, almost to prehistoric times, and in the dim recesses of my memory, when our headquarters was located in Los Angeles, I can recall an occasion or two when, with other staff members, we sat around speculating about the possibility that someday the Navigator budget would be in excess of $1 million, or it would be as much as $1 million. And back in those days, our annual budget for the total work was less than $100,000. And some of you have a budget almost that large. But today, the annual budget for the Navigators is in excess of how much? How about $40 million? I'm talking worldwide. At the beginning of this fiscal period, I believe we approved a budget in excess of $40 million. And I think this speaks eloquently to the graciousness of God and His faithfulness to the Navigators over the years and to our staff. And we have reason to rejoice for His provision and His graciousness in providing this kind of financial resource that is now being invested in helping people. So I think it's a real testimony to the Lord. Today we want to talk a little bit about some of the ways in which God has led the Navigators over the last 40 years relative to fundraising, some of the lessons we have learned. And I want to touch briefly on the biblical basis for fundraising. What did Paul do relative to fundraising? And Bob Potter is going to give us an update on the Daily Walk ministry, which has been one of the most significant things that we've done in the last 5 years. Russ Reed is going to give us an update on the planned giving aspect of development. And we'll talk about our purpose and our reasons for doing this and what the result has been. We've been in this about 9 years. We'll talk about whatever you'd like to talk about: church support, direct mail, telephone solicitation. Talk about the future. What do we have planned for the future? And then at the end, we will save ample time for questions and answers. We won't take questions during the presentations, but we'll take them at the end. And we want to allow ample time for anybody to ask any question that they would like to ask. So that's where we're headed. I want to begin then by talking about why do the Navigators make their financial needs known? Why don't we just pray about our needs? Why don't we just, quote, trust God to supply our needs? Don't we believe that God's work, done in God's way, will not lack God's support? Someone wrote to me several years ago, and they said, "Where is the faith of Dawson Trotman? If he was around, he wouldn't let you raise money by direct mail. He wouldn't let you engage in fundraising activities." And I was glad that I could write to them and tell them that before Dawson's homegoing, the policy on never making needs known had changed. And that it was Dawson who made the decision. It was basically his decision to change our policy from never making needs known to making them known. And during the early years of the Navigator ministry, fundraising was not something in which we engaged at all. We never took offerings at conferences. We never sent out financial appeals. We never dropped hints, even, to our constituents saying, we have a need, won't you pray for us? And in fact, we were told, if a non-staff person brings up the subject, change the subject. And then the day came when finances became an increasingly difficult problem for the Navigators. Income began to decrease, the bills began to increase, and when the problem became really critical, Nav-owned property was sold, the proceeds used to reduce the indebtedness, and our thought was, God has taken us through a testing period, and now we've come through it, and He will now again begin to provide the financial resources we need. But He didn't. And that financial problem, that crisis, continued to repeat itself. I recall on occasions Dawson, instead of our going to the office on a given morning, we would stay in the home at 509 Monterey Road, which, as you remember from reading Doss, was the Navigator headquarters home, and all the office staff lived there. And we would stay home and we would spend the day in prayer and talking about our financial problems. And I remember one day Dawson, on the basis of the story about Achan, you remember Achan? He was the one who, after the destruction and the defeat of Jericho, he took the gold and the goodly raiments and he hid them. And that had been forbidden. There were no spoils of war were to be taken by Israel. And Achan violated this. And then, of course, in their next battle with Ai, they were defeated. And it was discovered that there was sin in the camp. And so Dawson read this portion to us, and he said, perhaps our problem is that we have a sinner in our midst. And he says, we need to search our hearts, and we need to determine whether or not it's sin that is keeping God from providing our needs. And I recall this rather vividly because at the time I was living in the Navigator home and I was also having a real struggle with cigarettes. And at dinner each night, you know, with Dawson and the staff around that big long table, I was just dying to get away from that table to get down to the drugstore to buy a package of cigarettes. And I would do this, and the minute I'd smoked one, I'd throw the rest out and swear I'll never do that again. And the next night, that's where I was again. And this had been going on for quite some time. I apparently didn't believe my smoking was the cause of the funding problem because I didn't confess it. I lived in fear of the day that Dawson would somehow discover that someone living in the Navigator home was also smoking cigarettes. And the day came when he made that discovery. And he came to me and he said, I understand you're having a real struggle. And I admitted that I was. And he said, well, I want you to know that I understand and that I know that for some people, breaking that habit is one of the most difficult trials that they can go through. And he said, I just want you to know that I'll be praying for you, that God will give you victory, and I know that He will. And that was rather unlike Dawson, so. He was very loving, but he was also very hard on himself and at times equally hard on those that were associated with him. But he was also very loving. Dawson then decided the Lord might be leading the Navigators to follow Paul's example, where there were periods in Paul's life when Paul supported himself by working with his hands. And so the Navigators entered into three activities that were calculated to generate income that could then be used for the support of the Navigator ministry. And the Navigators opened a radio store in downtown Los Angeles to repair and sell radios. That was a bit before television. And we entered into a second business to sell fluorescent signs for advertising. And the third activity was representing a Christian publishing house out of Wheaton, Illinois. And our territory was everything west of the Mississippi. That was how I became a Navigator. I joined the staff to represent Van Kampen Press to all the Bible bookstores and all the religious bookstores west of the Mississippi. Well, after a couple of years, it became evident that God must have some other solution to funding for the Navigators. And Dawson then decided that he would share our struggles with three longtime friends of the Navigators and get some outside counsel that we then thought might help us discover God's will for us. And the first man he went to said to Dawson, "I've tried to talk with you about your finances and you've refused to discuss it." And so I concluded that some well-to-do individual was picking up the bills. But you weren't free to tell me who, so you wouldn't talk about it. And he said, "I'm delighted to know the Navigators need my help financially." The second person that he went to see was a lady who was the chairman, the president of her company. Her husband had died, and she'd taken over the presidency of the Kerr Jar Company. And she was a longtime friend of the Navigators. And as Dawson was relating our struggles, tears began to trickle down Mrs. Kerr's face. And this was absolutely devastating to Dawson because he felt that he had offended her. And this was rather unusual for him to be talking about money. He felt like he was violating a principle. He felt guilty, and now Mrs. Kerr was crying. And so he said, "Well, I apologize for whatever it is, Mrs. Kerr, that has offended you." And she responded by saying, "Dawson, these are not tears of offense, but these are tears of joy. To realize an organization that I love as much as the Navigators needs my help financially." She began to give generously and did so for many years. And the third businessman, the third man that Dawson talked to was a businessman, and he responded very positively. He said, "I am delighted to know the Navigators need help financially, and I want to be a part of that." And then he turned in his Bible to 1 Kings 17, and he showed Dawson the story of Elijah, where first the word of the Lord had come to Elijah. Ahab was out to cut his head off. And so he said, "You've got to hide. Go hide by the brook Cherith, which lies before Jordan on the east, and the ravens will bring you food." So the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and the evening, and he drank from the brook. But because of the drought, he had also prophesied the brook went dry. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah again and said, "Okay, now go down to Zarephath. There's a widow down there. I've commanded her to feed you." And the process by which, it doesn't say this, but the process by which he commanded her was Elijah had to ask. He says, "Go down there and make your needs known to her." So here we had a biblical precedent for the fact that God might change our policy from never making needs known to making them known. And this council and the previous experience at tent making and the other things that we had done all the time in prayer, this extended over probably a 2 or 3 year period struggle, we finally came to the conclusion that God was indeed leading the Navigators to change their financial policy. I think it's significant to realize we did not want to do this. We did not want to change our policy. We did not want the responsibility of raising money. And we felt deep within our souls that there was something more spiritual to never making your needs known. And we did not want to change. But we had come to the place where we felt if we refused to change, we'd be disobedient to the leading that God gave us. So, in 1949, for the first time in Navigator history, a letter containing a financial appeal was sent to our constituents. And the response was not miraculous, but it provided for immediate needs. And we did this once or twice in the ensuing years. Then in 1951, God led the Navigators to launch their very first fundraising program. Our goal was to raise $51,000 to pay off the indebtedness on the Navigator home, 509 Monterey Road, and to pay off the indebtedness on the office. And to us, $51,000 was astronomical because it was approximately equal to our budget in 1951. So we entered into this program with great apprehension. We were convinced, I think, that we needed to do it, but that our donors would respond. We felt sure there would be lots of negative response to our sitting down with them and talking about money and asking for financial support. So the verse that Lauren chose, and Dawson put Lauren in charge of this project, it was 1 Kings 18:36, the last half, where Elijah is saying, "Let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I have done all these things at thy word." And we wanted people to realize that we were doing this. See, we did it somewhat apologetically. But we wanted people to realize that we were doing it because God had led us. And we launched the program, went through the intensive period, maybe a month of fundraising. God enabled us to reach our goal, in fact, to exceed it slightly. And we got almost no negative responses. And we felt that the whole process had been honoring to the Lord. And it was a tremendous revelation to us that we could sit down with people and share our financial needs in a way that would produce a positive response. The dust had barely settled on this program when Dawson came home from a trip to Kansas City, Missouri, and he announced to us that we, as an organization, had accepted the challenge to raise $110,000 in the following six-week period. Now, prior to this, Dawson had seen Glen Eyrie, taken a report of Glen Eyrie to Billy Graham. Dawson at that time was associated with Billy in his crusades, handling the follow-up work. And Billy sent George Wilson, his business manager, and other team members to see Glen Eyrie. The Graham Association decided to buy it. They were going to buy it and then loan it to the Navigators for a period, indefinite period of time, until they were ready to convert Glen Eyrie into a Christian academy. They placed $50,000 down in option money, began their fundraising, and then gradually Billy developed the conviction that God did not want him to dissipate his efforts. He was an evangelist. He was not to get into schools. He was not to do anything but evangelism. So he called this meeting in Kansas City. He announced his withdrawal, and in the meeting he turned to Dawson and he said, "I believe God wants the Navigators to have Glen Eyrie. Will you accept the challenge of raising this money?" And if I could put it in perspective for you, I would say, because the 110 was more than our annual budget, today, 1984, if we were launching a similar effort today, we would be aiming at a $40 million goal, to raise $40 million in the next 6 weeks. See, that's how small we were in those days. And you know, it took us 3 weeks just to get organized. At the end of 3 weeks, we'd raised almost no money. I had gone on one finance call with Dawson to a businessman in Long Beach, California, and he and Dawson had gotten into an argument. And that was the last finance call that Dawson ever made, I think. And we raised no money, and we alienated, for at least the time being, a friend. But it took us 3 weeks to print our brochures, to organize, and to begin traveling around the country and sharing the opportunity that God had placed before us to purchase Glen Eyrie. Failure. See, failure to raise that money would have meant that we would have owed the Graham Association $50,000, we'd have had to return all the contributions we'd raised, and we would have been deeply in debt. So there was a lot more involved in just failing to get that down payment on time. Once we began to travel, God began to lay it on the hearts of people all around the country. And our overseas staff, of course, there were communications from Dawson to our overseas staff, and they, in a unique way, God led this laid this project on their hearts. For instance, the staff in Japan told us, don't send us any money that comes in for us during the month of September. Put it all in the down payment fund. We'll live by faith. And they have since said, since that time, they had more food, better food, more of this or that than they had ever had before, which was an evidence of God's provision. There were nationals around the world who, hearing about the project, sent their contributions, some of them amounting to no more than $2 or $3. The average gift was $25. The largest gift was $2,500. Businessman in Southern California mortgaged his home in order to have something to give. But in a miraculous way, the money began coming in. 2 days before the deadline, I received a phone call. I was down in the southeast, told to go to Houston, meet Dawson in Houston for the signing of the papers. So I arrived on the 27th. Dawson was there. I didn't know how much we'd raise, so I asked, and he said, well, we still need $40,000. 2 days to go, we needed $40,000. The end of that next day, we called the office. $22,000 had come in that day. So on the day of the deadline, we needed $18,000. One of the businessmen in Houston that was going to be a co-signer with us on this note got excited about what was happening. So he said to us the morning of the day of the deadline, September 29th, he said, you still need $18,000. He said, I'm going to schedule a meeting of my friends at my club, and we'll go there for lunch. And he says, I'll raise the $18,000. Whatever you need, I'll raise it. Before going to luncheon, Dawson called the office, and that morning $10,000 had come in, so we went to the luncheon needing $8,000. Mr. Henkamer raised the $8,000. Came back to his office. About 3 in the afternoon, we called our office to find out if any more money had come in, and $8,000 had come in. Dawson was embarrassed. He says, I got to go tell Mr. Henkamer we don't need his money, so we did this. We went into his office, told him. He said, well, he said, it's a big project. You're going to have a lot of expenses. I want you to keep the money. So we were happy with that. But you know that when we actually signed the papers, $5,000 was due for fire insurance, and they wouldn't transfer ownership without that being paid, and $3,000 was due in legal fees. So we actually needed not $110,000, but $118,000, and that's exactly what God provided. And then when we went down to the bank in Houston to get the money, our staff had been told, telegraph the money to Houston. We went to the bank. It wasn't there. By the time we called back and found out where it was, which bank they'd sent it to, banks were closed. And here again, evidence of God's hand, Mr. Henkamer was the chairman of the wrong bank. So we got in after hours and got our money. And there were many, many miracles that took place in that six-week period. Many, many evidences of God's hand of blessing on that project. So one more time, we had entered into a major fundraising program, and God had blessed. We had made the need known, and God had laid it on the hearts of people to respond. Then each year, we had a property payment that was due. We owed $27,000 each fall as a property payment on Glen Eyrie. And each year, we went to work in about August to try to raise this money. And each year, every payment was made on time and in full. One more testimony, one more evidence of God's blessing on the whole process of sharing needs and asking people to respond. But you know, during that same 10-year period, from 1954 until 1964, we had tremendous financial struggles. Our operational funds were significantly below what it was costing us to operate. And we struggled with that year after year after year. And for some reason, we simply did not come to grips with that problem. We lived with the problem. Spent a lot of time in prayer. Did everything we could to cut costs. But we didn't go after, we didn't enter into any kind of a fundraising program until 1964. And then in 1964, the decision was made, we've got to do something about this problem. So we entered into another major fundraising, national fundraising program. In those days, the ministry was divided up into 13 regions in the U.S. So we went into region number one, did our development program, moved on to the next region, then the next. Took us 2 years to do that program, region by region. But God provided over $6 million as a result of those fundraising efforts. We raised money not only for headquarters, but also for staff in that program. And then, for the first time in a number of years, once again, we had adequate financial support. 1964. 1974, we again entered into another national program. During this program, we raised a little over $4 million. In the initial trust, we raised a little below four, maybe three, five. We needed about four, but in the months and years that followed, the additional funds came in. So let me give you a little resume here of these major events in our history on finances. First, God led the navigators to begin to make needs known. Secondly, Anchor Home Base was our second fundraising campaign, raised the $53,000. The third effort was the Glen Eyrie purchase. Our objective was $110,000, and the amount raised was $118,000. '54 the annual payments were made on Glen Eyrie. Then in 1963 and 4, we did our national development program and raised $6 million. 1973, we worked with our staff in Great Britain. The program was called Program for Progress. When we launched this program in Great Britain, John Stott told us, you cannot do that type of thing in this country. Sitting down with people and talking about finances is an American method, and it will not work in Great Britain. You will offend people. But we believe that God led us, and our British staff and our American staff, we believe that God led us to do that. And we trained our staff in five key locations, from Glasgow in the north to London in the south. We gave them three training sessions over a period of 3 weeks, and at the end of the 3 weeks, they began to make appointments and calls. And as a result, they reached their goal. The giving level in Great Britain never dipped down below the level that they reached through Program for Progress. And God was honored. People came to Christ through the program. Very, very positive response. 1973, our Decade of Development program, which some of you remember. I think the fact that every time we have launched, we've entered into a major effort, God has blessed it. I think this helps to confirm, at least in my mind and my heart, the fact that God did indeed lead the navigators to change their financial policy. Now, here are some of the lessons that we have learned over the years. First of all, God led us to change our policy. Secondly, and I think this is very important, and incidentally, you have a list of these. You don't have to make notes on these. They're on the handout. God supplies the financial needs of the navigators in direct proportion to the time, the energy, the prayer, and the skill that we invest in making needs known. I think that's very significant. It's not only true for us as an organization, but it's true for us individually. Thirdly, there are no quick or easy solutions for funding a ministry. Careful planning with plenty of prayer and hard work are essential. We learn that God can be honored and glorified through the principle of making needs known. We learned that doing a thorough job in the ministry, and this And this is, I think, especially applicable to field staff. It does not generally ensure adequate funds, but making needs known and asking for financial support are usually necessary. Not always, but usually. And then number six, Navigator constituents enjoy sharing in the support of the Navigator ministry because it makes them feel more a part of the work. They feel like they're a part of the ministry. They feel like they're a part of the team. Number seven, giving follows ministry, but not all support must come from those to whom we have ministered. It's also biblical to make needs known and to solicit those to whom we have not ministered. Individuals who engage in fundraising learn new skills. We've seen this with our staff. It is a maturing process for them to go out, meet people they have not known before, and talk about a subject as difficult as fundraising. It's a maturing process. And they learn to do it, and they learn to do it and be comfortable with it. And number nine, a donor must be cultivated and informed, developed as a genuine friend. It's more important to get the individual than to get his money. It's the long-range view. Fundraising efforts, number 10, must broaden the base of support. We can't just go to our donors, but we must continually find new donors. And the reason for this is attrition. Every donor has a lifespan. Some donors give once, some give 2 years, some 4 years, some 20 years. But every year there are a certain number of donors that, for various reasons, will no longer give again. Some of them go to be with the Lord. And that sort of cuts off their giving. And others have interest factors that change. And so we must continually work at generating new support, broadening the base. Number 11, seeing people personally is the most effective method of solicitation. Nothing we can do is more effective than that. And then, of course, we know about pace setting. We have to set the pace. If we're going to raise money, we also have to be givers. Can't ask people to do something that we're not willing to do ourselves. I read somewhere recently that nonprofit organizations in the U.S. are at an all-time high. There are 330,000 nonprofit organizations in America. Many of these are Christian organizations, and most of them engage in fundraising. Some do not. Instead, they practice what's sometimes called the faith principle, which being interpreted means looking to God without making needs known. And Christians who champion this method of support don't believe that God can be honored by asking people for money. And because I sign all the appeal letters, I get the negative responses. And I get people who write to me and say, I don't know how many times I've gotten letters from people saying, why don't you follow the practice of George Mueller, who never made his needs known? Why don't you do that? Why don't you trust God instead of sending us solicitations by mail? And do you know what? I have never, ever received a letter from someone saying, why don't you raise money like Paul the Apostle? Never. The obvious question then is, what did Paul do? Well, let me mention two or three things that Paul did. First of all, it seems that there were periods in Paul's life when he made do with whatever God provided. And during these periods, he did nothing to meet his own personal needs. Philippians 4, 10 through 13, he said, I greatly rejoice in the Lord that at last you've renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you've been concerned, but you've had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I've learned to be content with whatever circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. Now I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. Now, George Muir, in his autobiography, says that God led me to adopt the policy of never making needs known. Very significant. And God's provision for George Mueller's ministry validates that fact that God led him not to make his needs known. Organizations and individuals who claim that God is leading them not to make their needs known had better have their needs met. Because if their needs are not being met, then God did not lead them to not make their needs known. They'd better consider some other alternatives. That's just logical. We've had staff members who have said, God is not leading me to make my needs known. I remember one of our earlier missionaries who's done one of the most outstanding missionary ministries in Navigator history said that. And he went to his part of the world, and for 4 years he got along on what God sent in. When he came back on furlough, you know what he did? He got busy and raised his support. Because for 4 years, he did without. And it was difficult for him. It impeded his ministry. It made it difficult for his family and for his children. And if we're going to claim that God is leading us not to make our needs known, we better have our needs met. That's the only validation that God has, in fact, led us to do that. Now, there's no text clearly stating this as a principle for funding that I know of. Still, we have the precedent. We have the examples of providential provision. God fed and watered and clothed the nation of Israel for 40 years in the wilderness. He provided for Elijah on a daily basis. So there is a biblical basis for not making needs known. But no proof text. Okay, secondly, talking about Paul's life, secondly, there were periods in his life when he worked with his hands to earn money. And these earnings he then used to support his ministry. Acts 20, verses 33 and 4, Paul said, I've not coveted anyone's silver or gold or clothing. You yourselves know that with these hands of mine, I have supplied my own needs and the needs of my companions. And in 1 Thessalonians 2:9, surely, my brothers, our toil and hardship, we work night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone. In 1 Corinthians 9, Paul says, the principle of support for a Christian worker is that he will receive his support from his ministry. But he said, we choose not to do that for various reasons. We're going to work with our hands. Earned income, then, is a valid method for funding a ministry. And most of us are probably not aware of it, but over 20% of our annual budget in the Navigator ministry, over 20% of our income is earned income from the sale of materials, from income generated from conferences. So we practice this principle. Sometimes field staff will go to a new ministry, and they'll get a job part-time, full-time, until they have developed a broad enough constituency to support themselves. It's a valid principle. And then the third precedent that we have from Paul's life are those occasions when Paul engaged, and sometimes very aggressively, in securing financial resources. He was not bashful, he was not apologetic, nor did he beat around the bush when he wrote to the Corinthians about their giving. In 2 Corinthians 9, verses 1 through 5, he says, there is no need for me to write about this service to the saints, and I guess that's a little tongue-in-cheek because he wrote. Not only did he write, but he sent Titus and Titus's friends. Very aggressive. He said, "For I know your eagerness to help, and I've been boasting about it to the Macedonians, telling them that since last year you and Achaia were ready to give, and your enthusiasm has stirred most of them to action. But I'm sending the brothers in order that our boasting about you in this matter should not prove hollow, but that you may be ready as I said you would be. For if any Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to say anything about you, would be ashamed of our having been so confident. So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to visit you in advance and finish the arrangements for the generous gift which you had promised." So what do we learn here? Well, we learn that they had made a promise. The Corinthians, the Christians living in Corinth, apparently a need had been presented to them, and they had responded, and they had made a promise, and today we'd simply call that a pledge. And now Paul wasn't totally confident about this expression of good intentions, knowing the propensity for procrastination in the human species. And so what did he do? He wrote a letter. And he wasn't satisfied with just writing a letter, but he sent somebody to ensure that they would follow through with what they had said they would do. And that's why I say it seems clear Paul was more aggressive in his fundraising than anything the Navigators have ever done. On another occasion, Paul let his needs be known. He said in Romans 15, verses 23 and 4, "But now that there is no more place for me to work in these regions, and since I've been longing for many years to see you, I plan to do so on my way to Spain. And I hope to visit you while passing through, and to have you assist me on my journey there." Now, what did he mean by "assist me on my journey there"? Was he talking about prayer support? Well, if you check the original language, you'll discover that he's really talking about material support. Food, clothing, money, whatever. Material support. Paul is talking about a personal need. And he says, "I hope that you'll help me on my way." Making needs known has both Old and New Testament precedent. In Exodus 25, God tells Moses to build a tabernacle. He said, "The resources you can get from the people, make the need known." Exodus 35, he presents the need, and the people respond, and the need is met. 1 Kings 17, the Lord tells Elijah, "Go make your needs known to the widow in Zarephath." He did that, and as a result, she provided his food and lodging for as long as he needed help. 1 Chronicles 28, David is engaged in securing resources for the construction of the temple in Jerusalem. First, he allocates resources from the royal treasury, then he gives of his own personal resources, and then he solicits the officials and the leaders of Israel. He makes the need known. He asks for a contribution. So, the three precedents that we have for funding a Christian ministry are these. First of all, to use personal earnings, Acts 20, verse 34. Secondly, to ask no one but God. And I think maybe the closest text that we could use for that precedent is 1 John 5, 14 and 15. And then to make needs known, Romans 15. Fundraising is part of the job. I think we have to acknowledge it. I think that for years, as an organization, we've been negligent to say that to our staff. There's a pastor out here in the Midwest who was a cadet at the academy, came to Christ through the Navigator ministry. And he told our local staff member, he said, "The reason I'm not on the NAV staff today is because I didn't want to be engaged in fundraising." I think perhaps the Lord also had a part in that, in leading him to be a pastor. But see, I think that's an issue that people who are coming on staff need to face. Am I willing? And if you are one of those who say, there are a few things I like less than asking people for money, well, please know you're not alone. That's not unique. It is rare indeed that any of us can say we love to do it. We've all been down that road. We're not all there now. We're not all dreading it now, but we've all been there when we were. And many of us have learned, many of our staff have learned to enjoy it. It's possible. We've all listened to that tape recorder that plays in the back of our mind that expresses all of these unbiblical concepts about fundraising. And it says things to us like, it's more spiritual to ask no one but God. And it tells us, ask people for money and you'll offend them. And these are all unbiblical concepts. And I think we have to sort these out. What is biblical and what is simply emotional or cultural? It is possible to feel good about fundraising and to enjoy doing it, as we learn to do it. Well, one of the men that had been in one of our staff fundraising seminars, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that our department provides these for the past couple of years. We've been providing the seminars around the country. Many of you have been in them. And after one of them, one of the young men wrote and said, I've been on staff 9 years, and now, for the first time, I feel comfortable and confident about making my needs known. So it is possible. And we're available to help you in any way that we can. I think you all know that the fundraising seminars are available to you, as well as materials, a presentation manual that will enable you to explain the Navigator work and take you right through the whole process of boiling it down to how do you ask and what do you ask for, and other materials which would give you some input. Scott Morton, whom some of you know, has been on staff for a number of years working in the Midwest region, is joining the development department this summer. He's going to live in his present home until his teenager graduates from high school, which will be next May sometime, and then he'll move to Colorado Springs. But this is going to be his primary job, to work with our staff in helping them raise money. So we are available to help you, and we want you to know that. Now, I want to take a few minutes now to have Bob Potter and Russ Reed present material on the areas of their responsibility. After they're through, then we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other activities in which the development department is engaged. 10 years ago, we started the development department with two people and a secretary, and we were engaged in about, two fundraising functions, two major fundraising functions. And today we have in excess of 20 people, and we're involved in 8 or 9 major fundraising activities. We can talk about those. We can answer your questions. So, Bob, why don't you come up? Bob, I think you already know, he's been on staff almost as long as Dawson Trotman, and came out of the business world. Russ is a product of the Navigator ministry, coming out of the San Francisco area, was for several years, I'm going to guess 6 or 7 years, was the director here at Glen Eyrie. And then we moved him into the deferred giving, planned giving department, and he's been with us now for several years doing a good job on that. And he'll explain what planned giving is, why we're doing it, and what some of the results have been. Bob?
Why don't you stand up here for a minute?
Okay, just a quick announcement here before I forget it. Jack Heald will give a tour at 3 o'clock today at Eagle Lake instead of 2. 3 o'clock, okay? Are we keeping you up? Okay, why don't you be seated then? Just for clarification, remember that's at 3 o'clock today at Eagle Lake instead of 2. All right? Some people have termed the daily walk the daily jog. Some have called it the daily run. The daily dash. Yeah, it is like that at some times. As Rob mentioned, the Daily Walk Ministry has really been and is still one of the most significant fundraising activities that we've had over the past 5 years and continues to be a vital part of our department. And let me illustrate why we say this. Back in 1978, Rod, believing that money follows ministry, began looking for a way for the development department to actually minister to our constituents, not just sending out letters, but also to minister to them, not only our constituents, but also to broaden our own base of people that we could minister to. And if you have your little handout there, if you could get that, we'll just kind of go through it together. And I'll make a few comments as we go along. That's not on your handout. Yes? You have them? Okay, why don't you just hold up your hands here and we'll get those to you. Okay? And if you don't have it right now, you just kind of look on with somebody and pick up one on the back table when you leave. Okay, the purpose of the daily walk is to get people into God's Word on a consistent basis. And based on that assumption that giving follows ministry, it's anticipated that daily walk readers would become donors, at least some of them. And this, too, is the primary purpose of the Daily Walk program. Now, the results of Purpose 1, hundreds of Daily Walk readers write us each year telling about the spiritual blessings of a consistent Bible reading program. And, boy, that's thrilling to read that. And the girls that work in this department especially, you can hear little squeals every once in a while and things of the letters that they get of how this ministers to people. A lot of people have a difficult time getting through the Old Testament. And the daily walk has made that come alive to them. See, the daily walk is not the end. The daily walk is the means of getting people into God's Word. That's it. That's the purpose. And when that happens, what happens? Well, people's lives are changed. And a lot of them like to write and tell us about that. And we really appreciate those cards and letters that we get from people telling us about that. And the new name and donor acquisition, the purpose number two, turn over on the back, and let me just give you a few figures here on that. We'll just go to the last part, because you can look at these later on. But when you go over to the where it says new name at the top here, it starts back at 1978, and it goes clear through 1983. And because of our new computer system, some of the figures we've not been able to get because of working up new programs and so on. But I got some figures just before we came over here. The total of new names that we've added to the Navigator mailing list actually is 515,525. That's a 500,000. That's exciting to us. Now, right underneath that, out of that number, now, I don't have the total figures on this because we couldn't get it up. So all I can go is through 1983 on this one. But we've had 59,000 of those people become active donors to the Navigator work. Now, that's really exciting. Now, the significant thing about that, if you turn over to the other page again, from a cost-effectiveness evaluation of that, it says nonprofit organizations spend approximately $5 for every new name that they acquire and put to their mailing list. Okay, so you multiply a 500,000 times $5. That would be the cost if we went according to that. It's kind of staggering, isn't it? Okay, but to make those people into donors, then they figure it costs at least $25 per name. And so when you take the 60,000 or whatever it is there and multiply that times $25, then you have another cost added on top of that. Well, the Daily Walk program accomplishes every bit of this. It says at a break-even cost. That is not correct. Not only has it been at a break-even cost, but has, in fact, at this point in time, are on a plus basis somewhere over the area of $100,000. And the reason that this figure says at a break-even cost is that we had not added into there what we do once a year is to solicit our daily walk people and ask them for a special donation to help keep us in the black and also help us to continue to give the daily walk to people that can't afford a subscription cost fee at no cost. And by the way, it's a very small percentage of our people that are on the mailing list that actually support it, probably less than 10%. So that many other people are getting it without cost. And it's exciting to us that it's provided, say, like to people that elderly folks that are on fixed income. And boy, you know, $15 or $20 is a lot of money. They just couldn't afford to get it. But this has been a means of feeding them spiritually. A lot of them can't even get out of the house, you know, to go to church. And this has been a way of helping them. Then also we get a lot of letters from prisoners, men and women behind prison bars, that this is their spiritual food. Some of them met Christ. Now, not everybody responds to the Navigator daily walk. Some will write back and say, take my name off. For instance, Rod got a classic letter from a guy. I wish we'd have kept that to frame that one. But this fellow wrote, and obviously he was not very well educated. And of course, he's like a kid that writes, you know, some of these things that you put on your refrigerator. He said, I have writ you.
I have wrote.
Yeah, tell him that, will you?
I have wrote you twice before to take my name off of your blankety blank mailing list. And then he says, if I get any more of your material, you are a dead man. And then at the end of the letter, after he signed his name, he put a P.S. and he said, I get discharged from this penitentiary in 1984. So I thought, where is that penitentiary?
Not only that, he called all of us together to make sure that name was off the list. So not everybody's that enthusiastic about the daily walk, but a lot of them are. Oh, mercy. But we have students, you know, that that have limited budgets, and especially during the time of when the unemployment was so heavy, we received letter after letter from people that were unemployed, the same. Boy, they were so grateful that we could continue to send that to them without charge, without cost. Because they hadn't worked in 7, 8, 9, 10 months. And boy, that had met a need spiritually in their life at that time. So anyhow, that's what this has done in that particular situation. All right? One of the most exciting things to us is we're not just after people just to have them on the mailing list, not just to make them donors, just to the daily walk. We want to expand that to where they encounter the entire Navigator work. And if you'll notice on the bottom here, it says the additional giving of daily walk donors. Now, we won't go into all the different amounts here, but that means designation for direct mail, where needed most, banquets, U.S. staff, and the overseas staff, which is by far, if you notice, the largest there, especially the U.S. staff and others in there. What this is saying, these are people, when we say daily walk people, we're talking not about the people that were already on our mailing list. We have a lot of that that's not even included. We're talking about the people that had never been on our mailing list before, and the daily walk was their first contact with the Navigators. Is that clear there? Okay. Those people, over the last 5 years, have given to other than the daily walk. Just a minute here. I have a new figure. 4,329,178 to other than the daily walk. They've given $3,892,510 to the daily walk. They've given more to other than the daily walk. Over $4 million to you folks and others. And boy, that excites us. And not only that, it's brought a lot of new people into contact with you and your ministry. When we go out on the fundraising calls, a lot of the people that we call on for you, their first contact is with the daily walk. And they want to see now a live, brand new a real live navigator, so they like what they read. They like what they read in Rod's letters, the tapes they get, and books that navigator people, and they want to get involved in our ministry. And so we're excited about it. That's what the Daily Walk is doing over the past 5 years. Now, Russ Reed.
Thank you, Bob. Now, we all sat here and heard Rod say that when a donor passes away, their giving stops. Remember that? Not necessarily the case. A little over 13 years ago, I think it was 1971, a widow became concerned that her assets, after she was gone and she no longer needed them, be used to, quote, promote God's work, unquote. She contacted the navigators and explained that her relatives, her children and so on, were not dependent upon her at all. They were all adequately taken care of. And she wanted to do something for the Lord's work. So we worked with her and worked out an agreement that through a will that the navigators and another Christian organization would equally share in what was left of her estate. After these arrangements were made, Mrs. Finley, that was her name, became a little apologetic, explaining that, you know, after she looked at her assets and what was happening to other people her age, there might not be much left. But we assured her that we were trusting God as she was, and we're very comfortable with what we had done. About 7 years later, Mrs. Fenley went to be with the Lord. I remember that year because although I didn't know Mrs. Fenley's name, and probably very, very few people in the organization knew of her, the navigators were experiencing some financial difficulties. We had cut and prayed and wrestled and struggled, and we still were looking at a $200,000 deficit at the end of our fiscal year, and we just don't do that. Well, during that time, or close to the end of the year, we received notice of Mrs. Finley's bequest, and that small amount of money had grown to just over $200,000. So God had a plan. He had made his plan 7 years before we had the need. Now, Mrs. Finley's last gift was far greater and probably much more, and more importantly, much larger than she could have ever possibly given during her lifetime. And it was a very important gift because it met a very critical need in the navigators. And I think this is a good example of the kind of things that planned giving is doing and can do. First of all, planned gift should meet the needs of, or should address the donor's needs and their family's needs first, based on 1 Timothy 5:8, where it talks about providing for widows. And then we can give information and ideas to the donor on how they can use their excess or unneeded or surplus assets to benefit the Lord's work after family responsibilities have been cared for. Well, what is planned giving? Well, planned giving can come into a number of areas. Basically, anything that is not a cash gift can become a planned gift. Planned giving is long-term giving. Mrs. Finley's illustration was 7 years. That can be relatively short for a planned gift arrangement. It's a long-term commitment. Arrangements are made now, but there is no benefit to the organization for a number of years. Planned giving appeals to people who are already motivated supporters of the Lord's work. And they often use a planned gift to increase the size of their total giving. What kind of things go into planned giving? Well, I won't bore you with all the technical demonstrations, or illustrations, or explanations. A will is the most basic, and by the way, that's a kind of planned gift. There is no benefit to the organization that a surviving spouse would need to know quickly upon the death of their spouse, or kids would need to know. So help yourself to these. if you can use it. Thank you. Ron?
I wish Francis Cosgrove were here to explain what he is doing in helping our staff raise money from churches. Francis is in Europe at the present time, teaching at some training, some summer training programs, so he couldn't be with us. But in your handout, you have a little bit of information about church support. And we are very high. We feel very positive about what's happening. More and more of our staff are getting more and more of their support from churches. And Francis has been working at this for 3 or 4 years. He has learned some lessons. He's learned how to approach a church. And he is available to help you if you have some churches out there who you think might be interested in your support. We've given you a little bit of information on it and some sample material. You can read this through it. And if you want some help on raising support from churches, contact Francis. He'll be back in the country in sometime in July, and he'd be available to help you. He can come to your area. If you can set up some appointments, he'll go with you and make calls with you and help you just to introduce you to the whole process of how do you contact a church, who do you talk to, how do you make the presentation, and how do you follow up on it. But our church support is on the increase. In the fiscal period 79 and 80, we had $992,000 in church support. 80-81, it was $1.3 million. 81-82, $1.5 million. And 82-83, $1.8 million. So it's growing. And I think it's conceivable that many of our staff could get very substantial church support if we'll just go to work on it. Cultivate that church, cultivate those pastors, not just where you go to church, but to locate other churches in the area who have money in their missions account and who are interested in supporting evangelical causes in their community. There is more that can be done with church support than I think most of us realize. So we want to encourage you with that thought. Now, let me open it up to some questions. What questions would you like to ask about fundraising in the Navigators? What are some of the things that we do that make you wonder why we do them? What are some of the things that's done in Navigator fundraising that makes you uncomfortable? What information, just general information, would you like to have about what we do? And I think the first hand was back here on this back row.
How does the NAV Press profit escape the paying taxes? How does it get around that?
It's perfectly valid for us to engage in activities of this kind that are directly related to the Navigator ministry. The day very well may come when we're going to have to make NAV Press a separate entity and pay tax on the money that they generate. But now there's no problem. It's all according to the law. Yes?
On that, too, we do file an unrelated business filing every year on income that would be suspect in order to stay above board. So any of those things can be used.
Okay. Where was... Did you... No particular advantage. If you can do it yourself and want to do it yourself, great. But so many of our staff are tentative about it. They think, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to do it. So Francis says, I'll do it for you just to introduce you to the process. Once they have done it, once they've seen a response and gotten a response, then they feel more comfortable. So it's just a way of helping the staff get into the whole process.
Is there a coordination of fundraising letters between various departments of the Navigators? Do you time them and coordinate between the various departments? A reason for that is a roommate of mine does support the various Navigator staff. He treated like a week, he got three or I think it was at least three fundraising direct mail letters from the navigators from different departments.
Well, I'd say if he got fundraising letters, they must have come from maybe one from the headquarters and a couple from field staff.
Headquarters and it might have been Daily Walk, I'm not sure. But it was like it was the navigators themselves from Colorado Springs. We were all
okay.
In one.
Okay. You're saying a plan giving promotion is a fundraising letter. Which is, but we do coordinate them. As far as we can, we coordinate them from here.
Could you explain how that works? You know, how many stories do you send out about someone who, got help from the navigators, and then a follow-up letter, and then another story to follow?
Right, we send about 6 appeals annually in which we tell a testimony, a story, and ask for support, and then we'll send 5 or 6 follow-up notes to follow those up. They are sent to about 25,000 of the 75,000 donors that we have. And we have probably 40,000 donors who are staff-only donors. They only give to staff, and they give regularly 6 or more times annually. They do not get those appeal letters. They get 1 appeal letter annually and 1 follow-up note annually. The rest of the donors on the staff give to Where Needed Most, Daily Walk, staff, missions.
Can you repeat that, Ron? That's an important point for the gang to understand, and I think we need to hear that again. Who gets those?
Who gets the appeal letters?
Yeah. The 6 annual.
The people who do not give to staff on a regular basis and who give only to staff. We call them staff-only donors. They only give to staff, and they give 6 or more times a year, 40,000 of them approximately. They do not get the financial appeal letters except 1 time annually at the end of the year. Yes. With what? How do you define the problem?
Well, just with people, the same thing you're just saying.
I see. Well, just tell your donor. If you're in touch with donors who don't want to get any financial appeals, you send us their names or have them send their names in, and we'll code them financial appeal exempt. Then they don't get them. Bob?
Bob, don't we send a copy of everything that we send out now to every staff person?
Theoretically, we do, but, there are so many new staff that come on that we don't have a process. We're not set up. We probably need a computer program.
But they would get more, by far, than the average donor out there if we're sending them copies of what we send out so they know what people are getting.
Yeah. Could you let us know when you're sending them out to know this particular appeal is going to this type of person?
How do you mean let you know?
Well,
you mean add your name to the mailing list?
No. Like, I'm thinking along the communication lines that Terry was talking about a couple mornings ago. All these letters that I'm getting, I wonder now, which of my donors got these? Say I have one donor who gives $1,000 a year. Now, did he get this? I was going to write him a letter next week. Did he just get this? And I was going to ask him for that $1,000.
Now, how could I communicate that information?
Well,
we'd have to send you an annual, a monthly report to do that. You'd have to tell us, or we'd have to say, pull all the people on the computer who give to you, and then we'd have to give you a monthly report.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, Rod. I meant what type of person.
So, do you send this just to the 20,000 or just to everybody?
Like, this copy, this letter that you're receiving now is sent to everybody on the mailing list. And the next month, this copy of this letter was sent just to 20,000 people who gave once last year.
Well, if you know what that donor is doing, then you already know that. If he gives six or more times, if he gives six or more times to you annually, then he doesn't get anything but that one year-end letter and that follow-up, year-end follow-up.
So by that, what you're saying there then, is you don't send that donor anything that first year until you know what he's given. Because you won't know whether he's given to you six times that year until a full year has gone by.
That would be true.
So you're saying that all of our new donors are not getting any financial pleas from the headquarters until after a full year of giving to us, and then you figure out what they've given?
No, they could get a financial appeal.
Yeah.
But let me tell you something about financial appeals. We live in an environment, in a culture, where the average person in America gets 900 third-class letters annually. Okay? 900. Some get more, some get less. 900 is the average. What's the message?
Something's
working. No? What is the message? The message is this. When a Christian organization has a need, they make it known. And when a Christian organization has no need, we don't hear from them. Now, if the navigators back out of direct mail and we discontinue it, your income can fall off. Because what that the message that will communicate is, we don't have any needs.
Roger, the flip side of that too, that, you know, from a field standpoint, if we get out of direct mail, you can almost be assured that the administrative charge is going to go up 3%, 4%, maybe 5%. Because the facts are that what we have to pay for is has to be funded. And Ron's department is the primary and sole source of that funding. So they take a lot of pressure. If you check with other guys and other Christian organizations or and find out what they're paying in terms of administrative costs, you'll find that ours are pretty slim in the region right now. And he's the reason why. And I think, I've worked with Ron for 6 years when I was in the headquarters job. And if anybody's got a handle on how to handle direct mail in good case in broad charge. In fact, if this year Brother left this organization, he could walk into any organization fundraising and write his own ticket. He is one of the best in the country. And I have great confidence, and it's not just in his technique in raising the money, but it's in the godliness and in the manner that he goes after and represents the navigators. And gang, I just give my amen and full confidence to Rod in terms of what he's doing for us. If we didn't have him, we'd be in tough shape.
Thank you. Every time I send him $100, he does that. Let me remind you, you talk about new donors. You don't want them to get direct mail? Fine. All you have to do to avoid that, if you feel you've got people who should not get direct mail from the navigators and they're a new donor or something, we'll make them financial appeal exempt. Just send us their name and address. No problem. They get coded on the computer and they just don't get any financial appeals. That's important to remember. Now, before we get off of this, let me also say, last month, we did another survey of our donor family. We asked them about direct mail. Almost 70% said, we like it. 6% didn't respond. 9% said, we'd prefer not getting it. And 18% were neutral. See, we get one or two negative responses,
And a negative response makes a far greater emotional impact on us than all the positive responses we get. I'm that way. We're all that way.
Just like sharing the gospel.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So.
I have a question about that and another question. But isn't it also true that if the donor that's giving to us is involved in several other projects, it will confirm their giving to the Navigators for a longer period of time?
Yes, it is. We say a donor commitment is only so deep if they give to just one person. If they start to give to two or three people in the organization, their commitment goes deeper. If they give to where needed most or daily walk or something else to a missionary project, their commitment goes that much deeper. And that also extends the donor life. So it's just a truism. The more fundraising you do, up to a limit, and we try to hit that happy medium. And sometimes we may not hit it.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, or had you talk about, is the phone bank. Some of us have had questions about that with our constituency. Can you fill us in on that?
Yes, I can. Last year, in May, we decided to experiment with some telephone work with lapsed donors. A lapsed donor is someone who hadn't given a gift anywhere from 18 months to 4 years, a year and a half to 4 years, no gift. Okay? I talked to each of our five RDs. I said, how would you feel if we did this? How do you think our staff would feel? I talked about it with each one individually. Each one ended the conversation saying, I have some concerns, but I think we ought to experiment with that. Five RDs. Well, I still wasn't 100% convinced we should do it. So then I went to Jack Mayhall, U.S. director. Jack ended the conversation by saying, I think we ought to experiment with it. I still had apprehension. So I went to Sammy. And I said to the Lord, I said, Lord, if he has any reservation on our doing this, I'm not going to do it. Sandy said, I think you ought to do it. We ought to do it. So 7 out of 7. Was God leading us or not? You'd be the judge. So we leased the equipment, and we called 16,000 lapsed donors. 23% on the telephone. See, what we did, we called them on the phone. We said, this is Julie calling from the Navigator in Colorado Springs. We're working on a project to get our staff back in Lebanon. Do you have a minute to listen to a tape? Minute and a half message. Yes, no. If it's yes, they hit the button, they listen to the tape. When the tape is over, their name and address and their giving record comes back on the screen. And the girl says, thank you, Mrs. Miller, for listening to Bob Vadano's tape. And if they gave $20 last time, she says, would it be possible for you to give $20 to this project? 23% said, I'll give you $20. 23%, I'll give you $50, whatever we asked for. 23% said, I'll do that, whatever it was we asked for. 10% more said, I'll send you something, but I don't know how much. And 10% more said, maybe I'll send you something. That's 43% positive response. Okay, they sent in a total of about 125,000. After we reached our goal, we called all the donors, 5,000 of them approximately, called them back on the phone. We said, we're calling this morning to say thank you. We called you a few weeks ago. You responded. We reached our goal for Beirut. You were a part of that. Thank you. And let me ask you, how do you feel about getting a call on the phone, soliciting a gift, asking for a decision? 88% said, love it, like it, better than direct mail, more personal. 12% said, makes me uneasy. So we thought, okay, there is something to be said for this process. And we've kept the equipment, and we're still doing some calling, like we'll call last year but not this year donors.
we call lapsed donors. We're doing a little bit of this for ourselves. But some other Christian organizations have seen what we were doing, and they thought that we were doing such an outstanding job that they are now contracting with us to do this for them. And I anticipate that this next year we'll have a net profit from that of $80,000 to $100,000. And let me also say, in my mind, I'm still not determined at all that we're going to keep this, that we're going to keep doing it. I am wide open to discontinuing it. As soon as we get some signals that maybe the Lord is saying, you've learned what you needed to learn, you've done what you needed to do, it's time to back out, I'm ready. Anytime.
Well, I think I really appreciate what you said in that, and I think the only problem I was pretty vocal about when it happened, and I think the primary thing was that we didn't need communication on it, so therefore you're kind of caught.
Yes.
And I think that we just had, as that I had a little of the background that you said, we were going to do this, then I could have been prepared for the people that made comments, because I didn't know whether they were last donors or, you know, you don't know.
Right.
So you get caught between a rock and a hard spot with the negative effect of not knowing what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You're right. Absolutely right.
Changing gears a little bit. On the through the daily walk and the other programs that are going on, including those donor cards, the people that you can contact, how does that work for us? I know that you, a lot of the country, have been running seminars and there were calls in advance that you're coming based on the cards for staff. Is that something you just receive in your own area or your own ministry?
Well, what we've done is provide the prospect cards, the donors cards, for any staff who've been through the fundraising seminar, so that we know that they've been trained in how to make appointments on the telephone, how to make the presentation, and so on. That's basically been our guideline. Okay, you have to work that out with your, with whoever you're responsible to. I think the way we were doing it before, the regional director was the one, his office was the one who coordinated that. So the request came to us through the regional office. Yes?
I'm just wondering how successful the family walk program has been, and then also, notice the banquet income has decreased. Is that a trend or are we learning some things there?
Okay, Bob.
On the family walk, we had we wanted to try this. At one time, we thought we would produce it ourselves. As you probably know, Walk Through the Bible produces the daily walk. And the cost factor of producing it ourselves is just astronomical. And so the Walk Through the Bible people asked if they could go ahead and do it. So they did. So we wanted to try that because we felt like there would be a constituency out there would like to take that. In order for us to even come close to breaking even, we set a figure that if we could get 2,000 to respond, and of course you knew that was with a subscription fee of $12, and that was even $3 less than Walk Through the Bible charged. And we had put the 2,000 on there by a certain period of time. We gave 3 months trial to begin with. And it took us 6 months after that to get it even up to the 2,000. And it's just not economically feasible for us to do that for our size of organization and the amount of people that it takes. And so what we're doing, we're discontinuing that. We've already discontinued it. We're honoring those subscriptions that are already in, but we're going to work with Walk Through the Bible for them to continue to go ahead and give that to them if they want it. So they'll be able to still get it if they want it. The ministry will still be there, but we can't do it. It's just not workable.
What about the banquets?
Now, what was the question then?
Well, I just noticed that income from 81 to 83
had decreased. There's not as much giving in the banquets now. It's still a tremendous public relations tool, but the cost ratio is quite a bit higher now. But it is a good public relations deal. But we haven't had as many banquets. We've just had a few banquets this last year. And so that's the main cause of the down in the income. We've saturated the country a lot with banquets. Now it's kind of a leveling off. Now it's beginning to kind of come back again.
I just wanted to clarify some statistics that you've given. That 88% of respondents to the telephone solicitation have said that they like it.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just from the ones who had given?
Yes.
Okay, so you didn't call back those?
No, I just called the 5,000 who had sent in a gift. Yes. There are any lapsed to donor. So if you have someone who was giving to you and they hadn't given in 18 months, they could get a call.
At one point, I've heard, I think, that the total number of donors for navigators is decreasing for the first time. Is that right? How does that coordinate with what Bob Potter said, that the number of daily block donors has increased, and some of the other things? Where does that number play into it? And why do you think are the donor total people decreasing that are giving?
We keep a donor on our active donor list for only 14 months. If we've not received a gift in 14 months, they go into the inactive. And so I would say that we probably picked up a lot of one-time gifts at banquets, at conferences, daily walk one-time gifts, and it's simply a cycle that we went through. Yes, it's going back up again. We're working at it a little harder. We picked up 16,000 revived and new donors through the telephone solicitation. So that's helping there. Yes?
Now, I want to mention earlier that I think one of the responses I've gotten from the math mailing, from the daily deal, is people have said that are only giving to me have realized that they have realized there's more to it than that. And I had one donor that was fairly one of my large donors, he doubled since he responded.
Yeah. Well, let me just say the telephone solicitation has turned into a rather significant ministry all by itself, because when you call people and talk with them, you often find you're talking to someone who's just lost someone through a death. They're unemployed, and our gals have been trained. We brought in a counselor to train them in counseling, and they pray with these people. They've led people to the Lord. We've had people come to Colorado Springs from out of state who said, my first contact with the navigators was on this telephone thing. I had no contact, and we couldn't believe it, and we came here to see if you were for real. And there's been a tremendous ministry that these gals have had over the telephone. From us?
Yeah.
NAV staff?
I'm NAV staff.
Good. Well, there's always pros and cons whenever any kind of fundraising you get involved in.
How do you handle people that whom you called to promise a certain amount and who never called to the fundraising?
We send a hitman around. If a person says on the telephone response, if they said, I'm going to send you something, they get a letter saying, we just talked with you on the phone today, appreciate your response, and enclosed is a reply envelope. And if we don't hear from them, that's the last time they hear from us. I don't understand the question.
Well, you really have another frame here. What
Uh-huh. Yes. What should you do? Oh, I think so, yes. Very definitely. A note, a telephone call, express appreciation. Very important. Yes. The motivation is to contribute something back. And we apparently it does, because we do get a lot of response from that. Very positive. Well, listen, we're over time. One last question.
I'd say I'm always blessed by
myself. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's have a word of prayer. We've gone over time and apologize, but I sort of felt like these were things we needed to talk about. Bob, would you dismiss us with a word of prayer? If anybody has a question that you still want to ask, Bob is around, Russ, and I'm around. If you don't see us, call us on the phone. We'd be glad to talk with you.